Hello. This is the IGCSE English as a Second Language Paper 2 Listening Test, Summer 2010. This test is in three sections. You will hear three extracts and will have to answer questions on what you hear. At the beginning of each extract, there will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all three sections twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen. Section A. In this section, you will hear a careers teacher talking about different types of universities in the UK. Listen and complete the notes. Write no more than three words and or a number for each answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Mr. Brown, the careers teacher at the school, and I'd like to welcome both Year 12 students and parents to this talk on going to university and all the difficult decisions you have to make over the next few months. This evening, I'm going to look at what you need to think about when choosing the right university for you. When choosing your university, it is very important to ask yourself the question, what kind of environment do I want to study in? In the UK, there are two models of universities. There are city-based universities, such as Leeds University, which has its teaching facilities located in the middle of town. Students travel from all over the city to get there, moving around with the rest of the general public. The city-based universities usually have large student numbers. Leeds University's student population, for example, is 33,000. The other type is the campus-based university, such as York and Exeter, where everything, accommodation, teaching facilities, and leisure activities, are all in one place. Most students live on campus and can walk to classes and to the library. These types of university are usually located on the edge of town, and in terms of student numbers, they tend to be smaller. York, for example, has a student population of 13,000. And Exeter has 14,000 students. The experience at these universities is very different from the city-based ones, but it is important to say that neither is better nor worse. I now want to look at both types of universities in detail. So, for this talk, I've chosen to look at Liverpool University and the University of East Anglia. Let's look at Liverpool first. Almost all of the university's teaching facilities and libraries are located on one site, very close to the centre of the city. The main train station is only 10 minutes' walk away, and the city's main shopping district and entertainment area are both nearby. The university site also has a recently opened sports centre, with a large swimming pool, dance studios and squash courts. It is considered to be one of the best in the country. There are also 12 restaurants and cafes on the site to cater for the almost 20,000 students who study at the university. However, there are parts of the university located outside the city centre. For example, part of the science faculty, the biology department, along with the sports grounds and the university garden, are located on the edge of the city. Accommodation is in three different locations around the city, about 2 miles from the university. So students have to walk or take the bus to get to class. Liverpool is a big city, but it is not always easy to find accommodation. However, The university finds accommodation in halls of residence for all first-year students. After that, students are expected to find their own place to live in years 2 and 3. But there are a few places available in halls of residence for final year students. Liverpool University students can enjoy the bright lights of a big city, as well as feel part of a caring community of their own. So, let's move on to the other type of university, the campus university, such as the University of East Anglia, usually known as UEA. UEA is located just outside the city of Norwich in the east of England. All the teaching, research facilities, libraries and accommodation are on one site within 10 minutes' walk of each other. 13,000 students study at UEA, and the university is set in 300 acres of varied parkland. At the centre is a man-made lake, which attracts thousands of visitors in the warmer months. The university fitness park is on campus and includes the largest indoor sports centre in the country. UEA also has an art centre. This has a fine collection of 20th century glass and metalwork and is open to the public. It also has a student theatre and film studios. Like all campus universities, UEA has almost all the facilities of a small town. There are shops, a supermarket, and even several banks. There are also quite a few places to eat and to socialise. Many students stay on campus for several weeks at a time as everything they need is in the one place. However, for those who want to go into town, there is a good bus service to Norwich, which also links to the coach and train station. The university has also just started a bicycle hire service for those who need to nip into town and are feeling energetic. But for those with a bit more cash, there is an efficient taxi service run by a student group. The university has spent a lot on accommodation. In fact, several halls of residence were designed by the country's leading architects. All of the university's 3,500 residences are self-catering, and the rooms are grouped around a shared kitchen, which is equipped with kettles and microwave ovens. All rooms have a wardrobe, desk, and chair, but students will need to bring their own pillows and bedsheets. Some rooms also have a shower and wash basin. The university can offer a place in a residence for all first-year students. UEA has quite a large number of international students, and they are all guaranteed accommodation throughout their whole course. Just to give you an idea of price, as I am sure this will be of interest to parents, the basic room without shower is £70 a week, and the ensuite ones with shower are £90. So, I hope this has given you some idea of what it's like to study at these universities. Next, I want to move on to the subject of finance.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Mr. Brown, the careers teacher at the school, and I'd like to welcome both Year 12 students and parents to this talk on going to university and all the difficult decisions you have to make over the next few months. This evening, I'm going to look at what you need to think about when choosing the right university for you. When choosing your university, it is very important to ask yourself the question, what kind of environment do I want to study in? In the UK, there are two models of universities. There are city-based universities, such as Leeds University, which has its teaching facilities located in the middle of town. Students travel from all over the city to get there, moving around with the rest of the general public. The city-based universities usually have large student numbers. Leeds University's student population, for example, is 33,000. The other type is the campus-based university, such as York and Exeter, where everything, accommodation, teaching facilities, and leisure activities, are all in one place. Most students live on campus and can walk to classes and to the library. These types of university are usually located on the edge of town, and in terms of student numbers, they tend to be smaller. York, for example, has a student population of 13,000, and Exeter has 14,000 students. The experience at these universities is very different from the city-based ones, but it is important to say that neither is better nor worse. I now want to look at both types of universities in detail. So, for this talk, I've chosen to look at Liverpool University and the University of East Anglia. Let's look at Liverpool first. Almost all of the university's teaching facilities and libraries are located on one site, very close to the center of the city. The main train station is only 10 minutes' walk away, and the city's main shopping district and entertainment area are both nearby. The university site also has a recently opened sports center, with a large swimming pool, dance studios, and squash courts. It is considered to be one of the best in the country. There are also 12 restaurants and cafes on the site to cater for the almost 20,000 students who study at the university. However, there are parts of the university located outside the city center. For example, part of the science faculty, the biology department, along with the sports grounds and the university garden, are located on the edge of the city. Accommodation is in 3 different locations around the city, about 2 miles from the university, so students have to walk or take the bus to get to class. Liverpool is a big city, but it is not always easy to find accommodation. However, the university finds accommodation in halls of residence for all first-year students. After that, students are expected to find their own place to live in years 2 and 3, but there are a few places available in halls of residence for final-year students. Liverpool University students can enjoy the bright lights of a big city, as well as feel part of a caring community of their own. So, let's move on to the other type of university, the campus university, such as the University of East Anglia, usually known as UEA. UEA is located just outside the city of Norwich in the east of England. All the teaching, research facilities, libraries and accommodation are on one site within 10 minutes' walk of each other. 13,000 students study at UEA, and the university is set in 300 acres of varied parkland. At the centre is a man-made lake, which attracts thousands of visitors in the warmer months. The university fitness park is on campus and includes the largest indoor sports centre in the country. UEA also has an arts centre. This has a fine collection of 20th century glass and metalwork and is open to the public. It also has a student theatre and film studios. Like all campus universities, UEA has almost all the facilities of a small town. There are shops, a supermarket, and even several banks. There are also quite a few places to eat and to socialise. Many students stay on campus for several weeks at a time, as everything they need is in the one place. However, for those who want to go into town, there is a good bus service to Norwich, which also links to the coach and train station. The university has also just started a bicycle hire service for those who need to nip into town and are feeling energetic. But for those with a bit more cash, there is an efficient taxi service run by a student group. The university has spent a lot on accommodation. In fact, several halls of residence were designed by the country's leading architects. All of the university's 3,500 residences are self-catering, and the rooms are grouped around a shared kitchen, which is equipped with kettles and microwave ovens. All rooms have a wardrobe, desk, and chair, but students will need to bring their own pillows and bedsheets. Some rooms also have a shower and wash basin. The university can offer a place in a residence for all first-year students. UEA has quite a large number of international students, and they are all guaranteed accommodation throughout their whole course. Just to give you an idea of price, as I am sure this will be of interest to parents, the basic room without shower is £70 a week, and the ensuite ones with shower are £90. So, I hope this has given you some idea of what it's like to study at these universities. Next, I want to move on to the subject of finance.
That's the end of Section A. Now turn to Section B. Section B. In this section, you will hear a radio interview with adventurer Harriet Jenkins. Next year, she will set off from Canada, hoping to reach the North Pole without any outside support. Listen and answer the questions. Indicate your answer by marking the box. If you change your mind, put a line through the box and then indicate your new answer with a cross. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Harriet Jenkins, thank you for coming into the studio today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Can I start by asking you about your childhood? What was it like?
I was a dreamer as a child, and I read all there was on Robert Falcon Scott and his tragic journey to the South Pole, and Shackleton and the great sailors. I've always been drawn to stories of great adventurers. I was the girl who fell out of trees and got muddy and lost my shoes, but I was never very sporty. I was never much of a team player, which probably explains why I'm now a solo skier.
Have you always been an adventurer?
No, I haven't. In fact, I worked in theatre as a marketing director for 8 years, and although I really enjoyed the work at first, I found that I was taking off more and more unpaid leave and was away for longer and longer. It just wasn't stimulating me anymore. I went freelance for a while, but then I felt I just wanted to focus on the adventure stuff completely.
What got you started with adventuring?
It was when I broke up with a boyfriend, and I really needed a life change. I was like, right, I'm going off to see the world, and decided to do it in a peculiar way. I ran into some rock art researchers. They were exploring bits of the deep Sahara and looking for new paintings, and finding them, which was amazing. So I joined them a couple of times a year for a while, finding new rock art. It made me see that the world was still a wild place, and you could go to remote parts of it if you planned carefully. And some places are really, really far away. Once you start, you can't stop. It gets to you, and you suddenly think, where else can I see that's so remote? Where else can I see what nobody else gets to see?
When did you start to become interested in the colder regions of the world?
I did my first expedition to the South Pole in 2004 with a team, and then in December 2006, I did a solo trip there and set the new world record, which was incredible. I knew what the record was, and I knew it was possible I'd get it. The record was 42 days, and I was aiming to do it in 40. In the end, I did it in 39 days and 9 hours.
Well, that's fantastic.
I wanted the expedition to be successful, and I wanted to be as prepared as I could be, and as fit. And because of that, I was able to set the new record. Though I'm sure it won't be long before somebody comes along and breaks it. But they can never take it away from me, and I'm sure I'll bore my grandchildren to tears with it.
And what did you do after that?
Well, the obvious next thing was to go and do the North Pole, and I really want to see the Arctic. It's not about records, it's not about doing anything first, it's about wanting to see that part of the world. I really want to spend some time in the Arctic. No woman has ever skied solo to the North Pole from anywhere in any way, though some great girls have had a go. You need to have a bit of luck, because you can get caught out by elements that are out of your control. In addition to that, I am also trying to do it unsupported, so no resupplies and no outside assistance at all.
And are you starting from Canada?
Yes, even though it is thought to be the hardest route to the North Pole. The ice drifts away from the pole towards Canada, so you end up on this big conveyor belt, and you take 2 steps forward and you're carried 1 back. Sometimes you're carried 3 back, so it's really depressing. And all the time while you're sleeping, you're drifting backwards again. So you're covering ground again and again.
Well, that sounds tough.
Yes, it is. And on top of that, the ice crushes up and piles up into these huge ridges, boulders and blocks of ice, piling up like terraces of houses, stretching from one side of the horizon to the other. And you have to climb over them. It's a mess. There's also the scary prospect of thin ice and being careful not to fall through it. That's what worries me most. And you need to give some thought to the pesky polar bears. So there are all sorts of risks, but that's why it's such a glorious challenge.
But a particularly dangerous challenge.
Yes. The random factor does worry me. But it's just risk assessment, and I have to prepare myself in the best possible way and deal with whatever situation comes up.
So, how long will the expedition take?
I imagine it will last 60 days. I've done 40 days by myself in Antarctica, which was the big test, and I breezed that. The loneliness wasn't an issue. In these environments, your days are so full. All day, all you're thinking about is, am I the right temperature? Are my hands too cold? Maybe I should put a hat on. Oh, my energy levels are dropping. I need to eat something. Have I drunk enough? My water's frozen, so I'd better get the other bottle out. I need something hot. It's time to camp. Better put my tent up. Now I've got to melt snow to make water. It's never ending. It's relentless. But the day just flies by.
And apart from the challenge, what else do you aim to get from the experience?
Expeditions like this are about escapism. The things that we are normally concerned about just don't matter out there. Going to work, paying your bills, none of it matters. Life becomes very simple. It's about moving in a certain direction, staying warm and staying safe. That's it. And that's why I keep on finding reasons to explore the more remote parts of the world. We all tend to live within our comfort zones and not realise what we are capable of. It's only when you push yourself to your limits that you learn about yourself. It can be quite an emotional experience.
Is there anything else?
I hope I'm a role model for young women, although that's a bit embarrassing. It would be lovely to think that people were motivated to achieve their own dreams because of something they've seen or read about me. I love talking to schools about it because the kids really get it. You can see their little eyes shining and their little minds wandering off and dreaming. And I hope that one day they're the polar explorers of the future. That would be great.
Harriet Jenkins, thank you.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Harriet Jenkins, thank you for coming into the studio today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Can I start by asking you about your childhood? What was it like?
I was a dreamer as a child, and I read all there was on Robert Falcon Scott and his tragic journey to the South Pole, and Shackleton and the Great Sailors. I've always been drawn to stories of great adventurers. I was the girl who fell out of trees and got muddy and lost my shoes, but I was never very sporty. I was never much of a team player, which probably explains why I'm now a solo skier.
Have you always been an adventurer?
No, I haven't. In fact, I worked in theatre as a marketing director for 8 years, and although I really enjoyed the work at first, I found that I was taking off more and more unpaid leave and was away for longer and longer. It just wasn't stimulating me anymore. I went freelance for a while, but then I felt I just wanted to focus on the adventure stuff completely.
What got you started with adventuring?
It was when I broke up with a boyfriend, and I really needed a life change. I was like, right, I'm going off to see the world, and decided to do it in a peculiar way. I ran into some rock art researchers. They were exploring bits of the deep Sahara and looking for new paintings, and finding them, which was amazing. So I joined them a couple of times a year for a while, finding new rock art. It made me see that the world was still a wild place, and you could go to remote parts of it if you planned carefully. And some places are really, really far away. Once you start, you can't stop. It gets to you, and you suddenly think, where else can I see that's so remote? Where else can I see what nobody else gets to see?
When did you start to become interested in the colder regions of the world?
I did my first expedition to the South Pole in 2004 with a team, and then in December 2006, I did a solo trip there and set the new world record, which was incredible. I knew what the record was, and I knew it was possible I'd get it. The record was 42 days, and I was aiming to do it in 40. In the end, I did it in 39 days and 9 hours.
Well, that's fantastic.
I wanted the expedition to be successful, And I wanted to be as prepared as I could be, and as fit. And because of that, I was able to set the new record. Though I'm sure it won't be long before somebody comes along and breaks it. But they can never take it away from me, and I'm sure I'll bore my grandchildren to tears with it.
And what did you do after that?
Well, the obvious next thing was to go and do the North Pole, and I really want to see the Arctic. It's not about records, it's not about doing anything first, it's about wanting to see that part of the world. I really want to spend some time in the Arctic. No woman has ever skied solo to the North Pole from anywhere in any way, though some great girls have had a go. You need to have a bit of luck, because you can get caught out by elements that are out of your control. In addition to that, I am also trying to do it unsupported, so no resupplies and no outside assistance at all.
And are you starting from Canada?
Yes, even though it is thought to be the hardest route to the North Pole. The ice drifts away from the pole towards Canada, so you end up on this big conveyor belt, and you take two steps forward and you're carried one back. Sometimes you're carried three back, so it's really depressing. And all the time while you're sleeping, you're drifting backwards again, so you're covering ground again and again.
That sounds tough.
Yes, it is. And on top of that, the ice crushes up and piles up into these huge ridges, boulders and blocks of ice, piling up like terraces of houses, stretching from one side of the horizon to the other, and you have to climb over them. It's a mess. There's also the scary prospect of thin ice and being careful not to fall through it. That's what worries me most. And you need to give some thought to the pesky polar bears. So there are all sorts of risks, but that's why it's such a glorious challenge.
But a particularly dangerous challenge.
Yes, the random factor does worry me. But it's just risk assessment, and I have to prepare myself in the best possible way and deal with whatever situation comes up.
So, how long will the expedition take?
I imagine it will last 60 days. I've done 40 days by myself in Antarctica, which was the big test, and I breezed that. The loneliness wasn't an issue. In these environments, your days are so full. All day, all you're thinking about is, am I the right temperature? Are my hands too cold? Maybe I should put a hat on. Oh, my energy levels are dropping. I need to eat something. Have I drunk enough? My water's frozen, so I'd better get the other bottle out. I need something hot. It's time to camp. Better put my tent up. Now I've got to melt snow to make water. It's never ending. It's relentless. But the day just flies by.
And apart from the challenge, what else do you aim to get from the experience?
Expeditions like this are about escapism. The things that we are normally concerned about just don't matter out there. Going to work, paying your bills, none of it matters. Life becomes very simple. It's about moving in a certain direction, staying warm and staying safe. That's it. And that's why I keep on finding reasons to explore the more remote parts of the world. We all tend to live within our comfort zones and not realise what we are capable of. It's only when you push yourself to your limits that you learn about yourself. It can be quite an emotional experience.
Is there anything else?
I hope I'm a role model for young women, although that's a bit embarrassing. It would be lovely to think that people were motivated to achieve their own dreams because of something they've seen or read about me. I love talking to schools about it because the kids really get it. You can see their little eyes shining and their little minds wandering off and dreaming. And I hope that one day they're the polar explorers of the future. That would be great.
Harriet Jenkins, thank you.
That's the end of Section B. Now turn to Section C. Section C. In this section, you will hear a talk by Dr. Smith about a project his university students are doing in primary schools in Scotland. Listen and complete the sentences. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Dr. Smith, and I teach architecture at Moncrief University. My students have recently become involved in the kitchen garden movement. A kitchen garden is a garden created to grow delicious vegetables and herbs. This is now a nationwide program to create a kitchen garden in every primary school in the country. The focus of the program is on the entire process from the garden to the table. The aim is to educate young children in years 3 to 6 about food. It is important for children to learn about how to grow food, how to cook it, and also learn about what happens to the water you need to clean the vegetables that you grow, and what happens to the water that you use when you wash the dishes afterwards. The problem was that many primary schools did not have a kitchen to cook the food that the children had grown. Some schools had old rooms or science blocks which they could convert, but others did not. And so our architecture students were asked to design a prefabricated kitchen classroom for them that was cheap and could be put up in any school across the country. The students were given a description of the kitchen classroom they had to design. It requires 4 or 5 ovens and preparation areas along the sides of the room. In the middle, there is a large table where the latest food from the garden or local market is displayed. And then there's a much larger area in the same room that is a dining space to seat around 20 to 25 people. It is here that the children, helpers, such as parents, and the teacher eat the food that they've prepared together. Just outside the kitchen classroom, there is another eating area, and next to that is the garden. The aim is to bring all the elements, the garden, eating, preparing, cooking, and celebrating food, very close together. Let me tell you now about what one of my students, Holly Turner, did. She decided that the most inexpensive material to use in her kitchen classroom was recycled cardboard. Most of us think that as soon as it gets wet, it collapses. But it doesn't. In fact, it can be waterproof. The Japanese have been experimenting with this material for many years, and they are expert in using cardboard for many different purposes. Holly researched the area carefully and came up with a very exciting and attractive design. Another student, Peter Burgess, decided to use products that are already in the shops, as they are relatively cheap and of good design. A company called Macready makes furniture, which comes in kits that people assemble at home. Peter's system used large prefabricated wooden blocks and kitchens, which he ordered from the Macready catalogue. He came up with a very adaptable, flexible, but well-designed classroom kit. Several of the designs have been accepted and put up in primary schools in the country and are already in use. So let me tell you about what goes on in a kitchen classroom. One thing to understand is that they are not regular classrooms. It is not about blackboard learning or watching PowerPoint presentations. It's about learning through making. It's getting the children to work with their hands, to use all the sharp knives that are available in the kitchen, to put things on the stove, to try things out. That means that these children are touching and using dangerous items in the classroom. The teacher can't be watching all of them all the time. But what is interesting is that the children quickly understand why safety in the kitchen is vital, and they soon grasp the idea of how they need to be responsible when working there, and along the way, they grow in confidence and get a sense of achievement. The children spend about 45 minutes a week in the vegetable garden that they have helped design, build, and maintain. This is an important part of the process of linking the garden with the kitchen, and the kitchen with the dining table. They grow vegetables from seed, and learn about the seasons, and what to plant when. The program has been developing since it started 3 years ago. In one school, for example, the children wanted to extend the kitchen garden idea further and keep chickens. Thanks to a local farmer, they now have 3 of them, which are kept at the school in term time. They also spend about 1.5 hours a week in the kitchen classroom preparing and sharing a wonderful range of meals that they have created from the things that they have grown in their garden, and the food that they cook is delicious. Schools with kitchen classrooms need volunteers to help out with the children, to build the classrooms, to find kitchen equipment, to make clothes for gardening and cooking, and to bring in extra ingredients for the meals. This has allowed a stronger sense of community to develop, and it is thanks to these people's contribution that the program is a success and that we are teaching children to cook and grow into healthy people.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Dr. Smith, and I teach architecture at Moncrief University. My students have recently become involved in the kitchen garden movement. A kitchen garden is a garden created to grow delicious vegetables and herbs. This is now a nationwide program to create a kitchen garden in every primary school in the country. The focus of the program is on the entire process from the garden to the table. The aim is to educate young children in years 3 to 6 about food. It is important for children to learn about how to grow food, how to cook it, and also learn about what happens to the water you need to clean the vegetables that you grow, and what happens to the water that you use when you wash the dishes afterwards. The problem was that many primary schools did not have a kitchen to cook the food that the children had grown. Some schools had old rooms or science blocks which they could convert, but others did not. And so, our architecture students were asked to design a prefabricated kitchen classroom for them that was cheap and could be put up in any school across the country. The students were given a description of the kitchen classroom they had to design. It requires 4 or 5 ovens and preparation areas along the sides of the room. In the middle, there is a large table where the latest food from the garden or local market is displayed. And then there's a much larger area in the same room that is a dining space to seat around 20 to 25 people. It is here that the children, helpers, such as parents, and the teacher eat the food that they've prepared together. Just outside the kitchen classroom, there is another eating area, and next to that is the garden. The aim is to bring all the elements, the garden, eating, preparing, cooking, and celebrating food, very close together. Let me tell you now about what one of my students, Holly Turner, did. She decided that the most inexpensive material to use in her kitchen classroom was recycled cardboard. Most of us think that as soon as it gets wet, it collapses. But it doesn't. In fact, it can be waterproof. The Japanese have been experimenting with this material for many years, and they are expert in using cardboard for many different purposes. Holly researched the area carefully and came up with a very exciting and attractive design. Another student, Peter Burgess, decided to use products that are already in the shops, as they are relatively cheap and of good design. A company called Macready makes furniture, which comes in kits that people assemble at home. Peter's system used large prefabricated wooden blocks and kitchens, which he ordered from the Macready catalogue. He came up with a very adaptable, flexible, but well-designed classroom kit. Several of the designs have been accepted and put up in primary schools in the country and are already in use. So let me tell you about what goes on in a kitchen classroom. One thing to understand is that they are not regular classrooms. It is not about blackboard learning or watching PowerPoint presentations. It's about learning through making. It's getting the children to work with their hands, to use all the sharp knives that are available in the kitchen, to put things on the stove, to try things out. That means that these children are touching and using dangerous items in the classroom. The teacher can't be watching all of them all the time. But what is interesting is that the children quickly understand why safety in the kitchen is vital, and they soon grasp the idea of how they need to be responsible when working there, and, along the way, they grow in confidence and get a sense of achievement. The children spend about 45 minutes a week in the vegetable garden that they have helped design, build, and maintain. This is an important part of the process of linking the garden with the kitchen, and the kitchen with the dining table. They grow vegetables from seed and learn about the seasons and what to plant when. The program has been developing since it started 3 years ago. In one school, for example, the children wanted to extend the kitchen garden idea further and keep chickens. Thanks to a local farmer, they now have three of them, which are kept at the school in term time. They also spend about 1.5 hours a week in the kitchen classroom preparing and sharing a wonderful range of meals that they have created from the things that they have grown in their garden, and the food that they cook is delicious. Schools with kitchen classrooms need volunteers to help out with the children, to build the classrooms, to find kitchen equipment, to make clothes for gardening and cooking, and to bring in extra ingredients for the meals. This has allowed a stronger sense of community to develop, and it is thanks to these people's contribution that the program is a success and that we are teaching children to cook and grow into healthy people.
That's the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklets to be collected. Thank you, and good luck.